deep in the heart of flyover country, this is Spin Sold Separately.
I would like to personally congratulate California for, at long last, certifying their 2024 election results. Even though we are much closer to 2025 than we are to Election Day 2024. But, yeah, details. 37 days, that's all it took. 37 days for California to certify their election results. For what it's worth, Florida was mostly finished counting their ballots on election night and certified their vote 2 weeks later on November 19th. That is the first of many comparison points that we are going to examine today, but I get ahead of myself. Welcome back to Spin Sold Separately, everybody. I am JD, an early Merry Christmas to all of you. It has been an insane month. It is not calming down at all on my end, and I sincerely appreciate your patience with my inability to get back to the mic here. I actually had good intentions of doing this last night, which would have been Thursday night, and my daughter had control of our family room here in the basement, which doubles as my studio. And I use that word very, very loosely, but my studio setup is down here in the basement and shares a common space with the family room in the basement that we enjoy an awful lot as a family and when friends come over. And so she was partaking in whatever it was she was doing last night, and the room was taken over. So she's like, okay, well, I'll be up in a little bit. And I said, okay. And I sat down on the couch and I didn't last 15 minutes. One of the dogs came up and crawled up and nestled up next to me. And then pretty soon I had the cat on my lap. And the exhaustion took over, and I was out like a bad set of Christmas lights. But here I am. I haven't been home for 15 minutes. My daughter has a friend over tonight, and I basically had to kick them out of here and say, hey, just give me an hour. You know, I've got a recording I want to do. I got some things I want to talk about. And then you guys can get back to whatever it was you were doing. And they were great. They're like, hey, we're going to go grab something from a store, and they might go get something to eat. So I've got about an hour here. I don't think it's going to take quite that long, but I'm not going to have a whole lot of time to edit this. So you're going to get this in very raw, largely unedited form, warts and all. So I hope you enjoy. I got to say, it would have been awfully nice, especially under the circumstances, for President Biden. Yeah. Oh, by the way, Joe Biden is still the president. Not sure if anybody's actually seen him for the last, I don't know, month and a half, 2 months, 3 months, I don't know. We've seen very little of our commander-in-chief, and it would have been nice if a president who clearly does not have the dizzying schedule that most American presidents keep, would have been nice if he had found some time to get to the Army-Navy game this past weekend. Have you ever watched that? It really is something. It is just a piece of Americana. I think this was the 125th meeting between these two wings of the armed forces, the Army-Navy football game. It really is something to take in. I mean, people travel from all over the country to attend this. And I mean, there's military veterans all over the place. I do know that the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was there, and some other amazing American patriots, and it's such a great event. And yeah, it would have been nice if our president had taken the time to go there. I looked this up just a couple days ago. I think 10 presidents since 1900 have attended the Army-Navy football game. So it isn't universally attended by presidents, but I just feel like, you know, his last year in office, not a whole lot going on. I think it would have been a good look, especially under the circumstances with the state of our military. It's not like we're drowning in new recruits. There is a recruiting crisis going on in our armed forces that is troubling, to say the least. And then you've got what's going on around the world in the Middle East and with China and with Ukraine and Russia. And I think it would have been appropriate, but alas, it did not happen. But the Army-Navy game, it is a very cool event. It is not even really about the football. I mean, it is certainly is for the players. But for the viewers, I mean, it's there's the football aspect of it, but just the patriotic nature of it, the unapologetic patriotism and just Americana in its purest form. And I really really recommend that if you haven't taken one of those in recently, that you do it. It is really well done. It is well attended by the higher level of our armed forces. It is something to take in. As an American, I highly suggest, if you haven't watched it in a while, that next year you make it a point to take that in and show some appreciation to our dedicated armed forces. I'm sure you're all familiar with the Caitlin Clark saga. I've got some thoughts. For those of you that don't know, I can't imagine there's many that don't, but I'll humor those who don't. Caitlin Clark is a uniquely talented basketball player. She made a name for herself at the University of Iowa, and she gained national recognition when Iowa went on a run to the NCAA Finals in April 2024. Now, she had been very, very good before that, but when your team makes a run in the basketball tournament and reaches the Final Four, it just kind of elevates you to another level. And she leads Iowa to the Final Four in April 2024, and they eventually lost to South Carolina in the finals. And she was doing things that no one had ever seen a female basketball player do. She was basically a female Steph Curry, if you will. I mean, she could pull up from anywhere, routinely hitting three-pointers from 25, 30 feet or more. I mean, she'd put it up from the logo and just bury these shots with unprecedented accuracy. Her passing was so next level. Her vision of the court, being able to basically throw, almost like an NFL quarterback, throwing her teammates open, just passing the ball to a place where only her teammate could get it. I mean, it was impossible to grasp how good she was. She set a multitude of records, not only at Iowa, but for Division I basketball, for overall NCAA. I mean, she broke so many records. I can't even get into all of them here, but a few of the highlights here. She's the all-time leading scorer, male or female, in NCAA basketball history. She holds the record for most points in a season. She holds the record for the most three-pointers in NCAA Division I history. She has the most career assists, the most free throws made. She's a two-time Naismith Player of the Year and a two-time AP Player of the Year. I mean, she's a generational kind of talent that captivated the sports-loving public and brought unprecedented attention and fanfare to the women's NCAA tournament. Her rivalry with Angel Reese from LSU, I mean, it became must-see TV. If you were a sports fan, this really became something that you did not want to miss. It was incredibly entertaining. The basketball was incredibly high level, and she became kind of an icon. I mean, I could go on and on about her college records, like I say, NCAA, Iowa, Division I, records all over the place. So she gets drafted, predictably, number one overall in the WNBA draft by the Indiana Fever, who, you know, usually when you're picking number one, it's because your team was not very good last year, and Indiana was not good in 2023. So they ended up with the number one overall pick, and they took Caitlin Clark, which everybody pretty much expected. And, you know, there's always a question about how somebody's game is going to transfer to the next level. I mean, we talk about this in football all the time. You know, see some college stars go to the NFL and prosper, and other college stars go to the NFL, and it just doesn't seem to work out for them. So you never really know. Well, she gets drafted by Indiana and proceeded to break even more records. Now, this was her first season against other pros in the WNBA. This is the Women's Professional Basketball League. Here's some of the records she broke just this year. Most assists in a season. Most points by a rookie. Most three-pointers by a rookie. Most assists in a game. And just for good measure, set the record for the most turnovers. Which is not, obviously she's playing against much higher level competition than she was in college. And she handles the ball a ton. You know, given those other records or assists or scoring, you know, free throws, she handles the ball basically all the time for her team. So the fact that she set the record for the most turnovers in league history, not completely surprising, being that A, she's a rookie, and B, she has the ball in her hands all the time. So the weird part of this story is the way that throughout the entire year, how do I say this? She wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms by the rest of the WNBA. She took countless unnecessary hard fouls throughout the year. I mean, from getting just blatantly trucked in the open court to getting gouged in the eye on a flailing block attempt by an opponent. You know, she'd get shoulder checked just in between plays during dead ball time. I mean, the highlights are out there. They're all over the place. The highlights of her greatness and the highlights of her getting flat out abused on the court. I mean, she was physically bullied on the court in the WNBA in this rookie season. Now, she did a very, very good job of staying above it all. She never complained. She never backed down. She never backed away from the challenge. She never even really engaged in it. She just kept playing her game, which is, I mean, her game, it's just better than anyone else in that sport right now. She passes every single eye test. If you watch the games, she pops because she's the most talented player in that sport right now. And the league enjoyed unprecedented viewership, record attendance, and record merchandise sales based on this generational talent entering the league. And, I mean, this follows the doctrine of the high tide raises all ships. Everyone across the WNBA was making more money because Caitlin Clark was suddenly a part of it. Salaries were going up. Attendance was far higher than it had been before. Again, you know, the merchandise sales, the TV deals. I mean, everything got better because Caitlin Clark became a part of this league. So, okay, so she's an amazing player, fun to watch. Everybody's making more money. There's more eyes on the product. The WNBA is as popular as it's ever been. Why was she never accepted? Why wasn't she welcomed with open arms? Well, she's white. I wish it were more complicated than that, but number one reason, with an asterisk, she's white. Over 60% of the WNBA is black. She's white. And a certain number, a not insignificant number, of other players, of league front offices, other coaches, this was obviously something that bothered them. And you could tell. You could just tell by watching. They didn't like that this white woman from the middle of the country was getting all this attention when they felt like they'd been there for, I believe the WNBA is 25 years old now. They didn't like that she came in and got all this attention. So, yeah, she took a lot of abuse on the court. She took some barbs in the media. You know, not necessarily direct barbs, but very passive-aggressive stuff said by other players, by, like I said, you know, people involved with teams throughout the league, front offices, coaching staffs, whatever. You could just tell. It was just, there was a palpable irritation from some involved in the WNBA. But like I said, she never engaged in this ridiculous, tired, divisive, racist waste of time, energy, and resources on this stupid discussion, no matter how many times she got ran over on the court. Here's an amazing stat. 17% of the entire league's flagrant fouls were perpetrated on Caitlin Clark. Let me say that again. Across the entire WNBA, 17% of the entire league's flagrant fouls were committed against Caitlin Clark. That's not coincidence. There's no way one player coincidentally gets almost one out of five flagrant fouls committed against her across the entire league. There is no way that that's by chance. But again, she stayed above it all. She never took the bait. She just kept playing. And my admiration for her only continued to grow and grow as a result of that. Because she didn't let herself get drawn in. She clearly did not want to have this stupid race discussion. She just let her play do the talking. And she led her team to the playoffs, a team that drafted number one because they were so bad. In 2023, Caitlin Clark helped lead them to the playoffs in 2024. So by every measurable statistic, whether financial for the teams, for the league, or by her own play and how her game did translate to the professional level rather seamlessly, by every single measurable statistic, her first year in the WNBA was a roaring success. So, she wins the Time Athlete of the Year award last week. Not surprising. She lifted the WNBA to a level it's never been at before, and that's good. There are a lot of talented players in the WNBA. It's fun to watch. I just like to watch good players play sports. I don't even care what it is, whether it's tennis or football or baseball. I like watching talented athletes do their thing. And this was just the latest example of that. She's the best female basketball player on the planet. So she wins Time Athlete of the Year. And she gives a lengthy interview to Time Magazine, obviously, as a result of this. And after all these years of staying strong and staying above the race baiting and staying above the racism that was forced on her, both directly and indirectly, she finally gave in. And she gave in 100%. She verbally went down on both knees, bowing down in apology for her white privilege. That's a quote, her quote, white privilege, and that she was only able to play in the WNBA because of all the black players that came before her. She did everything the racist left and the race baiters have been waiting for her to do since she exploded onto the scene in 2023. I'm going to make this very plain. I am over this racist bullshit. Over it. Jemele Hill, who apparently was too racist even for ESPN, has spent an entire year ripping down not only Caitlin Clark, but even insulting the fans, her fans, with brainless and baseless presumptions and projections of her own racism. Here's a few examples. In regards to the league's ratings drop after Caitlin Clark's team was eliminated from the playoffs. Now, again, with Caitlin Clark being involved, the league ratings, TV ratings, were as high as they've ever been, higher than they've ever been. Her team, her Indiana team, gets knocked out of the playoffs. And not surprisingly, the ratings for the other games dropped, because when the best player gets knocked out, the ratings go down. I give you Exhibit A, Tiger Woods. When Tiger Woods missed the cut in a PGA Tour event, guess what happened to the weekend ratings? They went into the toilet because he was the best player. People enjoy watching the best player, and when the best player is no longer involved, ratings go down. It has nothing to do with race. It has nothing to do with the fact that Tiger Woods was black, that the ratings went down. It was because Tiger Woods was the best golfer on the planet at the time. This had nothing to do with Caitlin Clark being white. She's the best female basketball player on the planet. And when her team gets knocked out, yes, the ratings are going to drop. Very predictably. Well, Jemele Hill, she called any headlines highlighting this indisputable fact that the ratings fell after Caitlin Clark and her Indiana Fever were knocked out. Jemele Hill said that any headline regarding this obvious fact was, quote, irresponsible. Never mind the fact that it's true. She doesn't like it, so she called it irresponsible. Regarding Caitlin Clark's popularity, Jemele Hill, quote, we would all be very naive if we didn't say that race and her sexuality, she's straight. Apparently that's an issue for Jemele Hill too. If we didn't say that her race and her sexuality played a role in her popularity. I'd love to know what Jemele Hill is basing that off of. I mean, it would be very naive, she says, if you didn't say that race and sexuality played a role in her popularity. It must suck to see the world through this lens. Then, you know, because Jemele Hill, all she does is race bait and hate on white people like very few I've ever heard speak in my entire life. So then she mocked the fans that came after her, rightfully disagreeing with Jemele Hill's endless projection of her racism on them, saying that, quote, if you're mad at something so obvious, that means that you were never a real fan of hers or the WNBA. You just liked her as long as she could be your avatar to hate on black and queer women. End quote. That's what Jemele Hill thinks of Caitlin Clark fans. Based off absolutely nothing. She's basing this off her own feelings. Her own racism. That is the only thing backing this up. And again, I've talked about this before. This is what makes me so angry, is people spouting these kinds of vile, disgusting opinions, and then saying that we're the ones that hold them, and that it's just an indisputable fact that we hold them. And any denial that we might say, no, actually, that's not how I feel, not even close, well, that's just our white privilege talking, you see. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, we as white people are never, ever able to get out of this box that Jemele Hill has decided to put us in because she is among the most racist people on the planet. So, Jemele Hill, who obviously hates white people with the infernal fury of a thousand suns and incidentally hates America with every fiber of her being, you know, she must sit around and wonder where that $4 million net worth she's sitting on came from, given how she spews nothing but racial tropes and oppression claims into any camera or microphone she can get her hands on. I don't know. Apparently, America hasn't been as rotten to her as she'd for some reason love to believe. But anyway, enough with Jemele Hill. She's the poster child for what went so unnecessarily wrong with race relations in this country the last 10 or 15 years. Let's move on to a woman named Sheila Johnson. Sheila Johnson is the co-owner of the Washington WNBA franchise. She's angry because Caitlin Clark was named Athlete of the Year and wonders why, quote, why the rest of the league wasn't given recognition. Saying that, quote, singular focus on one player can bring division among the players. I mean, this woman co-owns a franchise. Does she know how individual awards work? Like, when Time named President-elect Trump Person of the Year, Did they consult with every single one of his campaign staff to make sure they all got proper credit? This is not how individual awards work. I mean, do we need to throw out MVPs in every single sports league now? Because Sheila Johnson doesn't think it's fair to everybody else. You talk about the everyone gets a trophy generation growing up and taking over industries and institutions. What an asinine statement. It's not fair that she gets named Athlete of the Year. Why can't we highlight the rest of the league? Well, because that's not how Athlete of the Year awards work, lady. Good grief. Yeah, apparently, yep, no more Most Valuable Players. No more Comeback Player of the Year. No more, Cy Young for the best pitcher. No more, we can't have nice things. This is the left. The left does this to everything. You can't just have this superstar basketball player who's doing things that no one in her sport has ever done at her level before. Nope. She's not the right skin color. You got to tear her down. She's getting awards. Well, no, we can't have those awards anymore. It's not fair that one person gets named Athlete of the Year, which by definition means a single player. I am 100% done with people that look at the world through this lens. Jamil Hill has a degree from Michigan State and has worked dozens of high-paying jobs throughout national media and is sitting on over $4 million. Jamil, I'm not interested in your story of oppression. No one alive today is facing the kind of oppression that blacks and other minorities faced in this country, and, oh, by the way, still face in other countries. No one is facing the kind of oppression that blacks and other minorities faced back in the 1960s. Least of all, multimillionaires. God, we have blacks and minorities on the Supreme Court, throughout Congress, throughout the Senate. The mayor of New York is black. The mayor of Chicago is black. 60% of the WNBA is black. Here's a few more stats. 53% of the NFL is black. 70% of the NBA is black. Blacks represent 13% of the population, but represent 14% of college students. Have there been historical inequities? Of course. They are well documented. Is there still room to improve? Well, of course. There's always room to improve everything. But what gets lost in this endless victimhood mentality and this endless racism, that's what it is. That's what Jamil Hill is spewing, is racism. Replace everything she says that involves the word white and replace it with the word black, and see if what she is saying could ever be said in a public forum in 2024. That's the easiest way to tell if somebody's being racist or not. Flip the races and see if you could still say it. That's the easiest way to tell. What gets lost in all of this endless, unnecessary racism is that America has done more to correct this historical wrong oh, by the way, did not originate with the United States. Slavery was around long before the United States was ever a thing. But the United States has done more than any other country or civilization in human history to make it right. And I will not even entertain any argument to the contrary, because it is just flat out not true. The idea that racial oppression and whites putting their proverbial boot on the chests of blacks and other minorities to keep them down in 2024 is categorically absurd, and it is easily disproven by any objective measure. No, not every single lingering effect of historical racism has been erased, but to pretend that no progress has been made at all and that it's basically 1962 out there all over again is mindlessly ignorant. Why is it Caitlin Clark's obligation to acknowledge the black players that built this league? Well, what about the white players? If 60% of the league is black, 40% of the league isn't. but she had to acknowledge the black players that built this league. Caitlin Clark has accomplished everything she's accomplished herself and with her teammates. Even in her apology for being white, she acknowledged, I wasn't given anything. I earned everything I have. But, and then she went into this diatribe about how she needs to acknowledge all the black players that built this league on whose shoulders she is apparently standing. No, she did all of this herself. Did the WNBA go to all her practices? Did the black players in the WNBA make all the sacrifices it took for her to dedicate her life to this sport the way she did? Did they do all that hard work for her? Did they stay up until 2 a.m. shooting jump shots when she had a final the next morning? Did they work tirelessly and make everything possible out of their God-given ability and set college records, get drafted number one on a terrible team, and then lead them to the playoffs in her very first year, breaking a ton of records along the way? She doesn't owe anyone anything, and she certainly doesn't need to somehow atone for her whiteness or her straightness. You know, as a Gen Xer, I can attest to the fact that racism in this country was all but dead. It was withering on the vine when I was growing up. When I was a kid, I loved baseball. Baseball was my favorite sport growing up. I didn't have many friends growing up, so my entertainment most afternoons and weekends was I'd throw a tennis ball against my garage. As an adult, I must pass my belated apologies on to my neighbors growing up. Boy, were they patient with me. But, I mean, I had my own little league going. I knew every major league roster. I knew every single player, every batting stance, every pitching windup. My favorite players ranged from Ken Griffey Jr. to Paul Molitor to Tony Gwynn to Wade Boggs. My favorite Twins players were Kirby Puckett and Gary Gaetti. I mean, I even did my all the stuff I admit in my older age here. I even did my own rankings as far as my top 100 favorite players. I can vividly remember doing this, writing it down on a piece of paper, you know, erasing a name here, putting it down there, putting a little arrow going up, a little arrow going down. And, you know, these rankings of mine that meant absolutely nothing, but they would change based on, you know, how good that, you know, how good they were playing, or whether or not they hit a crushing home run against my home team, or, you know, maybe I pulled their card out of a pack of baseball cards and now I like them a little more because I've got one of their cards in my hand, you know, stuff like that. You know what I never thought about one single solitary time? Their race. In high school, I grew up in, yes, a largely white neighborhood, and I didn't have, you know, the schools I was in did not have a ton of minorities growing up. In high school, the most popular kid in my class was one of the few black students. And no, he wasn't popular because he was black. Because no one cared. He was popular because he was incredibly funny, amazingly athletic, stunningly good-looking, and endlessly charming. That's why he was popular. When Tiger Woods broke into the PGA and absolutely took over the world of golf for a quarter century, did anyone ever demand that he acknowledge the almost entirely white history that the PGA had before him? No, because we were too busy watching him annihilate any challenger that got in his way, and we were all there for all of it. He vaulted golf ratings into levels that rivaled the NFL. Was that because he was black? No, it's because he was a unicorn and was the greatest player of an entire generation, the greatest the world of golf had seen since Jack Nicklaus. There was a time when people thought he'd be the greatest of all time. And that's why he drew the attention he did, not because he was black. When Serena and Venus Williams claimed professional women's tennis basically as their own for over two decades, did anyone demand that they acknowledge the almost exclusively white women that were atop the sport at the time. Steffi Graf, Martina Navratilova, Chris Everett. No, we all sat back and enjoyed the show because they were light years better than everyone else. They were so head and shoulders above everyone else. They'd often face each other in the finals of major tournaments because one would be the one seed, the other would be the two seed, and they'd beat the crap out of every opponent between them and end up facing each other in the finals. Did anybody care that they were black? They made more money in that sport than any female tennis players that came before them. Did anybody insist that they thank Billie Jean King? No, they did the work. They put in the time. We all watched in shock and awe that for a very long time, the two best female tennis players on the planet were sisters. Is anyone out there demanding that we see more racial equality in the NBA or the NFL because there aren't enough whites? Whites aren't proportionately represented? No, we just want to see the best. Sorry, not sorry, Jemele Hill. Caitlin Clark is the best right now. And I hate to be the one to break it to you, but Paige Beckers is going to be number one in next year's WNBA draft. And brace yourself, she's white too. As if that should matter at all in the 21st century. Is she going to have to do the same racial groveling that Caitlin finally gave into? Well, probably. Nobody asked these dumbass questions about ratings declines when Tiger Woods didn't make the cut at a PGA event, or when Michael Jordan's Bulls got bounced out of the playoffs. Because anyone with a brain knows that these people, the best players, are the main draws. These are the biggest stars. It's the same thing happens when Duke or North Carolina don't make the NCAA basketball tournament. Stars and historically dominant programs bring in more eyes. This is not rocket science. I'm telling you, racism in the 1990s and the early 2000s was all but dead, and it would have died if it had just been allowed to. But sadly, there's a percentage of our society out there, specifically the race baiters in our media like Jemele Hill and Joy Reid and Don Lemon, they don't want racism to die. It's their business. So they keep resurrecting it. The demand for racism far exceeds the supply in 2024, and it's the weirdest thing to say, and it's even weirder to watch it happen. These are the true racists today. Go listen to Ibram X. Kendi or Joy Reid or Jemele Hill for a while and explain to me how their rhetoric is any different from David Duke's, just with the races reversed. Racism was all but dead. We elected a black president by overwhelming majorities in back-to-back elections, once over a POW war hero. Did we elect him because he was black? No, we elected him because he was a generational political talent. Racism would die if it were allowed to, but there's some people out there that won't let it happen. They'll point it out even where it doesn't exist. Real racism is getting incredibly hard to find, but they'll make it up if they need to. George Floyd, Michael Brown, Jordan Neely, these are all cases where race was injected into a situation in which it had no relevance whatsoever, but was forced to become the primary point of discussion. Not drug use, not following reasonable police orders, not violently threatening innocent people on subway cars. Nope. Just race. Nothing more to it than that. I'm done. I'm done with people that talk like this. Is it possible to find an individual racist? Of course it is. I'd say it's about as easy to find someone that hates, say, Catholics. Or Jews. Yes, there will always be a sliver of irrational hate out there because people at their cores are capable of reprehensible behavior. But the degree to which our country and our society has righted these historical wrongs cannot and will not be ignored or minimized, at least on this show. Is every historical underrepresentation solved? No. Blacks are still underrepresented as a percentage of millionaires. They're still very underrepresented as a percentage of college professors. These will correct themselves over time if they are simply allowed to work themselves out, given the degree to which the roadblocks of historical racism have been eliminated from our society. It's already happening. And in a very short time, every remaining vestige of racism will fade into the annals of history. But sadly, people like Jemele Hill and Ibram X. Kendi will keep it alive, even when the vast majority of us want it to die. It is time for our California versus Florida comparison, because these governors are popular in their parties, they're young, and they're going to be around for a long time in the conversation of our national politics. So I think it's a good idea to take a look at the state of both states. That didn't come out right. I think it's good to compare both states as they sit right now, because California has been under Democrat rule for a very long time. Florida has been under Republican rule for a very long time. So let's just do a comparison. This is what the numbers are. You can be mad about them. You can disagree with them if you want, but these are the numbers that are out there. So the governor of California is obviously Gavin Newsom. He was elected in 2018 after serving as lieutenant governor. He was elected in 2018 by a 62-38 margin over Republican challenger John Cox. He was reelected in 2022 by a slightly smaller margin, 59-41, over Republican Brian Daley. Not sure if I pronounced that correctly. D-A-H-L-E. He had aspirations for replacing Joe Biden on the ticket in 24, and he really wasn't that secretive about it. He was less than thrilled with how the process ended up playing out, with the nomination basically being handed to Kamala Harris without any kind of primary. He even made fun of it on a podcast a week or two later, basically saying, yeah, boy, that was some primary, huh? You know, some grassroots effort. I mean, even he wasn't buying that grassroots bullshit. Anyway, Florida's governor is Ron DeSantis. He was elected also in 2018 by a very, very slim margin of only 33,000 votes in a state with, you know, almost about, I think at the time, about 20 million people. He won in 2018 by 33,000 votes over Democrat Andrew Gillum. It's hard to believe, given what's happened since then, both to DeSantis and to Gillum. DeSantis was reelected in 2022, this time by 1.5 million votes, 59-40, over Democrat Charlie Crist. He ran for president in 2024, running a rocky and somewhat disjointed campaign that ended after a disappointing second-place finish in the Iowa caucus, a race that he had thrown almost all of his resources into. These two are polar opposites on the political spectrum. Newsom is a staunch progressive Democrat, supports big government, big spending, heavier regulation and taxation, very heavy into climate change, green energy. The current abortion law in California is, quote, up to the point of viability, end quote, which they say is around 24 to 26 weeks. DeSantis, on the other hand, is a strong conservative Republican, more in favor of smaller government, fiscal responsibility, lower taxes, and he has a knack for emergency preparedness, has a, you know, a very strong history of dealing with hurricanes and other natural disasters in Florida. It's indisputable. He's been a very good leader for the state of Florida through, you know, those difficult times when those disasters hit. Florida's current abortion law is legal up to 6 weeks. So two opposite ends of the spectrum there as well. Let's start with the economy of both states. Home prices is always a good place to look. You know, how if you wanted to move to California tomorrow, what would you be paying for a house? Well, the median home price in California, this is a hard number to believe, $869,000. That is the third highest, behind only Hawaii and Washington, D.C. Isn't that strange? You've got two, you know, basically tropical Pacific places like California and Hawaii. So you'd understand why real estate would be more expensive there. And then you've got D.C. Why is there so much money in D.C.? Well, topic for another show. On the contrary, Florida's median home price is $433,000, which is the 21st highest. So California, third, Florida, 21st. The national average, incidentally, is $404,500. So both are above the national average. How about for rent? This is for an efficiency, because rent can vary so wildly from an efficiency to, you know, a three-bedroom, two-bath townhome. This is just on efficiencies. California, $1,856 is the median rental cost for an efficiency. That is the second highest in the country. Florida, $1,444, rating as the 10th highest in the country. If you're going to have these high real estate prices, well, you better hope there's a decent average income, right? Well, California's median household income in 2022, that was the latest data I could find, was $84,907. That is the 6th highest median household income in the country. Florida's was $63,062, which was the 15th lowest. So California had the 6th highest median household income. Florida would have been the 35th. Cost of living, gas in California, $4.22. Florida, $3.12. California is not shy about its disdain for fossil fuels and anything that comes from it. Electricity. The average electric bill in California is $132.57. Florida's is considerably higher, at around $243 per month. Everybody's got air conditioning. A lot of people have pools. And, I mean, the average temperature is much higher in Florida than it is in California. So the air conditioners are running far more frequently. So, again, California, $132.57. Florida, $243. Incidentally, Florida's electrical costs are about 33% higher than the national average. Not surprising given its climate. The total cost of living index, which is an index put out by a website called World Population Review. Total cost of living index for California is 134.5. That is the 4th highest, behind only Hawaii, Massachusetts, and Washington, D.C. Florida, their rating 102.3. That is the 21st highest. So total cost of living, California 4th highest, Florida 21st highest. How about income taxes? California has the 2nd highest rate of state income tax at 13.3%. Florida has no individual income tax, obviously tied for first at 0%. California ranks 49th at 13.3%. Corporate taxes, California ranked 41st, Florida ranked 16th. There's so many different things that feed into corporate taxes, but overall, on the average, California ranked 41st, Florida 16th. Overall on taxes, well, overall on income taxes, if you put those two together, California ranks 48th between individual and corporate income taxes, Florida ranks 4th overall on those two measures. Property taxes, California ranks 19th at 0.75%. Florida ranks 26th at 0.91%. So California a little bit lower on the property tax. Sales taxes, California has the highest sales taxes in the country at 7.25%. Florida has a 6% sales tax, which is the 17th highest. As far as GDP, how much your state is generating, California by far and away number one at $4.1 trillion. Florida, $1.7 trillion. They are the fourth highest, behind, obviously, California, Texas, and New York. So, that's a good summary of their economies. How about education? Overall education rating by U.S. News and World Report. Now, this is combining everything from elementary schools through secondary schools to universities, different choices out there. This is an overall rating. Again, given out by an outfit called the U.S. News and World Report. California ranked 23rd. Florida ranked number one. In literacy rate, California ranked 49th with a literacy rate of 71.6%. Florida ranked 42nd with a 76.3% literacy rate. How about grade level ranks? There was a lot of different examples out there. I chose fourth graders because in my opinion, I'm not a teacher, but you've got to get elementary school kids on track. I think if they fall behind early, it's really, really hard to help them catch up. So this is all these rankings here are based on fourth graders' average test scores. In math, California ranked 38th. Florida ranked 4th. In reading, California, 49th. Florida, 10th. In science, California, 46th. Florida, 12th. And in writing, California, 33rd. Florida, 7th. So across the board, very, very high performances by Florida schools, very, very poor performances by California schools. Graduation rate. The national average was 89.1%. California ranked dead last, 84.4%. Not a total surprise given those very low test scores across the board. 84.4% graduation rate for Florida, for California, that was the lowest in the country. Florida's 89.3%, and that ranked 33rd. If you go to just colleges, again, this is based off the quality of the schools, the number of choices, how desirable the destinations, all that jazz. California ranked number one and also has the most colleges in its state, not surprising given it's the by far number one population state. So California, number one in college ranks. Florida ranked number seven. Let's move on to crime. A ranking as far as all crime goes, aka general public safety. California ranked 42nd. Florida ranked 15th. In murder rate, California ranked 20th, Florida 25th. In violent crime rate, California ranked 45th, Florida 13th. Property crime, California 42nd, Florida 15th. So again, across the board, as far as just overall crime numbers go, Florida again significantly outpacing California, except for, I mean, the murder rate was pretty close. California's was a little bit lower, but they were almost identical. But overall, crime far less of a problem in Florida than it is in California. How about just general quality of life? I mean, these are two obviously very desirable destinations. Average temperature, you know, this is stuff I didn't know. Average temperature in California, they're actually the 12th warmest state at an average temperature of 59.4 degrees. Florida is by far the hottest state at 70.7 degrees. That is the average temperature in Florida, 70.7. Hence those high electric bills running all those air conditioners. How about days with sunshine? California ranks number five in total, I didn't write this down. That would have been smart to do. But as far as total sunshine, California gets the fifth most sun. Florida gets the 10th most. That was surprisingly low for the Sunshine State to be number 10. Incidentally, I think number one was Arizona. You know, the South, very heavily favoring the Southwest. Arizona, New Mexico, they were very high on that list. And we will finish this comparison with some population trends, because nothing says how happy a populace is with the place that they live like staying there or moving out of there. As far as current population goes, California is number one with 38.9 million people. Florida is number three at 22.9 million people. As far as representatives and electoral votes, now this is going to change in the next census because of population trends, i.e. increases or decreases that we will get into in a minute here. Currently, California has 52 representatives in the United States House, plus their two senators for 54 electoral votes. Florida has 28 representatives in the House, plus their two senators gives them 30 electoral votes. Now, as far as the trends go, population increase or decrease, California has lost 1.55% of its population since 2020. That ranks 48th, whereas Florida has gained 6.41% since 2020, and that is the third highest. Homelessness in California, 46 people per 10,000 are homeless. That is the fifth highest rate in the country. Florida has a rate of 14 per 10,000, which is the 19th highest. Now, governor isn't everything. Like I said, California has been largely controlled by Democrats for the last three decades. They did have a couple of stints with Republican governors. And Florida has been almost exclusively under Republican control, going all the way back to the late 1990s. In California, and we have been over this before, but here's a little review of just how, and both of these states have gotten very one-sided. In the California State Assembly, the Democrats have a veto-proof 60-19 advantage. They also have a veto-proof majority in the state Senate with a 30-9 advantage over the Republicans. Democrats have controlled all three branches of the California state government since 2011. So veto-proof majorities in both houses of their state government. Florida, in their state house, has 86 Republicans to just 34 Democrats, and their state Senate, 28 Republicans to 12 Democrats. And Republicans have controlled all three branches of the Florida government since 1999. I did not know that it went back that long. That was very interesting. So there you go. I know it's a lot of statistics there. I encourage you to go back and listen to that again, because I know there's a lot of numbers in there, and you know there's not many ways to make it super engaging other than just compiling the statistics and reading them off. I don't think you can go back and listen to that two or three times and argue that California has been governed better than Florida. That is my opinion as somebody who's obviously leaning more right in the current political climate. So obviously I'm giving this a look through a lens that favors Florida, but then I look at these statistics that don't lie. They're just the numbers are what they are. And I don't think it's debatable that Florida is in much better condition than California. Now, that is going to have a lot to do with how these states are governed from a governor perspective and from their state government. You know, that people always say, if you want to change the way your national politics are going, start at the local level. You know, get involved in your local and state elections. And, you know, this is why, because when you have super majorities like this, I mean, you can see how these two states have been driven further and further apart in their politics and you can see the statistical differences that have resulted, and you know the numbers are what they are, and with very few exceptions there, Florida just seems to outperform California on the vast majority of those metrics. So again, the names Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis are not going anywhere. They are going to be around in our national politics for years to come because they are both young and popular in their parties. So get used to hearing those two names because you're going to be hearing them a lot more as we get into, you know, once we get past the midterms and people start talking about the next presidential election. I know Trump hasn't even taken office yet, but it's amazing how fast we're ready to move on. You're going to hear those names a lot after the midterms, and when we start looking towards 2028, those names are going to come up an awful lot. That about wraps up what I wanted to talk about today, and thank you for bearing with me. I mean, that discussion on race, and I know it's so touchy to talk about stuff like that, but and I've avoided talking about it as much as I can to this point, but you know what? I'm comfortable being that pointed in my opinion on it because I don't think that that's a majority opinion. I think that is an incredibly small percent of people in this country that think that way. And I think it's almost entirely concentrated among media types and the hard left and the hard right. I don't think there's anyone in normal everyday society that looks at the world the way a few of those people that we discussed in that first segment look at the world. I don't think that's a majority opinion. I think it's less than 10% of people that look at the world that way, but sadly their voices are incredibly amplified because of the political and media power that those names that I listed off to you enjoy. And it's too bad because I think it puts race relations, at least, how do I say this? It casts a darker light on race relations than I think actually exists. I don't think Jemele Hill speaks for very many people when she talks the way she does. I don't think Ibram X. Kendi or any of these race baiters out there, I don't think they represent more than 10% of the country in the way they talk and think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm comfortable making my thoughts on it incredibly clear because I think the way I look at it is the way the vast majority of people want to look at it and do look at it. What's coming up? I'm going to get a little Christmas episode together in the next day or two here. And then we're going to take a little bit of a break over the holidays here because there's just so much going on. You've got stuff going on. I got stuff going on. I'm going to need to sleep for like 4 days straight once this is all done here because this winter, it is taking it out of me. My work days are tough enough, and then I get home and I'm having to shovel every other day. And then the days in between, it's like 4 degrees. It has not been very pleasant. I long for last winter when I think it snowed like 3 times here and every other day was 40, 45 degrees. It was fantastic. I'd never complain about winter again if it was always like it was last year, but that is not what we're getting this year, and my body is paying the price. But so we will get a little bonus Christmas-centric episode out here over the weekend, and then we will take a little break until after the new year, and then we will get back on schedule after the holidays. I'm working on an average people, average stuff piece that I think you guys will enjoy, and you know, we got all kinds of stuff in the works. And again, in mid-January, we're going to have that discussion with that friend of mine, the Harris voter. So we got all kinds of fun stuff in the works here. I will get back to you in the next couple days here with a fun Christmas episode because I think we all need to take a step back and really enjoy this time of year. Whatever else is going on in your life, it can be difficult. I mean, I had a talk with somebody just yesterday that, you know, her dad passed away this year, and she's having to face her first holiday season without her dad. I mean, she's a little older than I am. And I mean, it was heartbreaking listening to her talk about it, because you could tell that he was a big part of her whole holiday experience. And it's important to remember that people, you know, might be going through stuff like that. And we'll get into all that in our Christmas special coming up in a couple days. And don't worry, it's not all going to be Debbie Downer stuff. We'll talk about important things like that, but, you know, we'll talk about the lighter, more spiritual side of it too. So we're going to wrap here. Thank you once again for joining me. Again, this has been Spin Sold Separately. I am JD. Don't be a jerk. Make daylight savings time permanent. And I'll talk to you next time.